Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's another beautiful October day. We just had a really beautiful October day out at Blue Mountain Zendo yesterday. A whole day of poetry practice. Sitting and walking and writing outdoors and then speaking our poetry to each other. So that was pretty great. Several of you were there and co-leading that retreat with me was our dear friend Jisun Tova Green, sitting over there, who is visiting us from San Francisco Zen Center, and she's on an epic road trip up the coast and back down, visiting sanghas in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, because she's the liaison, sangha liaison for the Branching Streams network of those sanghas. And there are now seven, tell me the numbers again.
75 in the U.S. and 10 in other countries.
And 10 in other countries.
Wow.
Yeah. And likely to increase. Yeah. And every other year we have a gathering, a conference, a Branching Streams conference, and Michael and I have been to two of them, I think, and they're really wonderful. And they're open not only to priests, but to other people in Sangha leadership, you know, board members, other people too. So maybe one day we'll have one close enough to up here that some of you will get to go. So last weekend, we opened our 8-week practice period with a weekend retreat. And as most of you know, our theme for the practice period is the Vimalakirti Sutra. And so just a little review for anybody who's new. Vimalakirti was a legendary enlightened layman who lived at the time of the Buddha, and he was known for his great wisdom, compassion, and particularly skillful means. I like to just use the Sanskrit word upaya, because to me it's more than skillful means. It's skillful means that arise out of both wisdom and compassion. And what it means is the way to respond to suffering in our world, and the particularity of it, of the suffering in our world, in just the right way for each person or situation. And Vimalakirti was apparently a master of that and entered into all different realms of life. He was a merchant, and had a wife and a family, and he in the sutra, it tells about how he his wisdom was so profound that even the many scores of Buddhist disciples and bodhisattvas were humbled in his presence. These stories were passed down orally, and then written in the sutra probably around the first century of the Common Era. And the scene for this drama that's depicted in the sutra is that Vimalakirti allows himself to become gravely ill in order to teach others about the impermanence of this human life and the boundless nature of our true being, and also about the conditions of our suffering. So Vimalakirti is in his little sick room, in bed, in his house. And the Buddha requests his disciples to pay Vimalakirti a call and see how he's doing. And each one gives an excuse about how he's too intimidated by Vimalakirti's great wisdom, because once Vimalakirti showed him up, you know, when he was out preaching the Dharma, and Vimalakirti showed up and was much more wise and eloquent. So not only the disciples, but a whole list of bodhisattvas too, refused to go visit Vimalakirti until finally Manjushri, the great bodhisattva of wisdom, reluctantly agreed to go. And a whole host of beings assembles in the sick room to hear the exchange between Manjushri and Vimalakirti. And as you remember, those of you who were here last week, Manjushri asks Vimalakirti about his illness. You know, what's wrong? What are you doing? What's the treatment? How long have you had it? What are the symptoms? Instead of the expected reply, Vimalakirti says, "This illness of mine is born of ignorance and feelings of attachment. Because all living beings are sick, therefore I am sick. If all living beings are relieved of sickness, then my sickness will be mended." So in his illness, he feels a sense of compassion and connection and solidarity with all suffering beings. And of course, this sickness isn't just the sickness of the body, it's the sickness of our suffering that comes from our sense of separation, our sense of our greed, our ignorance, our hatred and aversion. And so his path as a bodhisattva, as an awakening being who understands the nature of suffering, and that in a sense we only are free from suffering in this matrix of being with all others. And so of course, when they are ill, we are ill, and when they are eased of suffering, we are eased of suffering. And the bodhisattva understands this deeply. So the next question Manjushri asks is, again, one of my favorite passages. I have several favorite passages, and I hope you will too as you get acquainted with this text. But the next question he asks is, how should a bodhisattva comfort and instruct another bodhisattva who is ill? I find this so moving and comforting and encouraging, because of course the life of the bodhisattva is a path, it's not a destination. And even a very experienced bodhisattva can sometimes become weary and discouraged. You know, who among us has not felt a little weary and discouraged, or very weary and discouraged, over the past couple of years? You know, maybe I will ask for a show of hands. Who has? You know, of course, it's been hard. So Vimalakirti gives a kind of list of answers. And the first one is, tell them about the impermanence of the body, but do not tell them to despise or turn away from the body. This is a pretty radical departure from some of the early sutras in the Pali Canon, the earliest Buddhist sutras, which sometimes seem to encourage a kind of repulsion towards the body. There are meditations that young monks, male monks, are supposed to practice, where they visualize beautiful women aging, their bodies decaying and dying, to generate a kind of repulsion towards the physical body. Notice whose physical body is being used in that exercise. And I've always felt a deep questioning of those passages, because I really deeply feel that it's possible to see beauty in every season of the body, just as we see beauty in every season and the cycling of the seasons of the earth. I don't know how many of you have been around dying people. Sometimes there's a beautiful, translucent, beauty to those who are nearing death. And we don't even have to call it beauty, but isn't there a way to view death and decay without repulsion? Yeah. And then, of course, birth arising, right? we see it every year, particularly in this part of the world where we have distinct seasons. Yesterday we were walking in the garden, and you could see the fall garden, you know, the insect-riddled leaves or the changing colors and the decay. And I just love the beauty of the fall garden, the textures and the colors. As it turns towards winter. So we can be reminded of the impermanence of the body without despising or turning away from the body. Next thing Vimalakirti says is, tell them about the sufferings of the body, but do not tell them to strive for nirvana. So yes, living in a physical body, we will feel the pains of injury and illness, and we'll encounter the greater harms that human beings inflict upon each other. And yet, here is another radical departure. He's saying that the goal of our practice is not to escape this world into some sort of static state of nirvana, completely removed from this very world. To find a way to live in this world with equanimity and peace and kindness. So next he says, tell them that the body is without, the translation says ego, but I prefer without self, without self-nature or separate self. Tell them that the body is without self, but urge them to teach and guide living beings. So that one sounds a little puzzling, but I think what he's saying is that though we know that the self is a construction of causes and conditions and the elements that create us, and we're always in flux, and so you can't pin down a self that is in any way fixed or separate from everything else. Although we can know that, we are in relationship to countless beings. And a bodhisattva embraces that reality of diversity and particularity in beneficial ways. That's the bodhisattva vow. Next thing on the list, tell them of the emptiness of the body, but do not tell them of its final extinction. So what this means, the emptiness of the body here does not mean a hungry belly. It means that the body is an impermanent entity, like we just said, that exists in flux in the matrix of all other existence. And final extinction here doesn't mean just death. It means stepping off the wheel of life and death into ultimate Buddhahood, no longer being reborn in a physical body. So once again, here's Vimalakirti saying, you must awaken to this life right here in this world, just as it is. And next, he says, tell them to repent of former harmful actions, but do not tell them to consign them to the past. What do you think he means? I think he means, instead of forgive and forget, forgive and remember. When we've done harm, whether intentionally or unintentionally, whether through malice or carelessness or ignorance, you know, we don't always mean to. Lots of the time we say, oh, but I didn't mean to, right? But you know, we're careless, we're thoughtless, we don't pay attention, and sometimes we do harm. And sometimes we do harm out of a reactivity, out of aversion. So, however it happens, we need to fully acknowledge it, We need to apologize if we're able, and to make amends where possible. And then we need to forgive ourselves and not self-flagellate forever, because that doesn't help anybody. And then we renew our vows to live a conscious, caring life. So instead of saying, well, that's all in the past, right, we remember and we learn. And we've all seen the consequences of human beings' short memory for past egregious actions. Right? I mean, I'm speaking collectively here. So again, Vimalakirti is really giving us a very powerful practice here. Powerful practice for living in the world. How to live with our own capacity to do harm. So then, he says, tell them to use their own illness as a means of sympathizing with the illness of others, for they should understand their sufferings through countless kalpas are really, really long ages, of their past existence, and they should think how they can bring benefit to all beings. So here he's saying that our personal sufferings, although they feel sometimes like we are totally alone and they are our sufferings, but really that's just another kind of self-clinging to think that. To think that we are so unique in our suffering. But he's saying our very experience of suffering is exactly what can open our hearts to others. And if we turn away from our own suffering, if we push or suppress our own awareness of our own suffering, we are much more likely to turn away from someone else whose suffering triggers our own, because that's pretty uncomfortable. Or we might judge or diminish someone or discount what they say if we're judging or discounting our own suffering. So again, this is a powerful practice he's offering us here. In the Tibetan Buddhist compassion practice of Tonglen, which means receiving and sending, we breathe in the suffering of others, imagining it as kind of dark and smoky, and then we breathe out light and healing. It's sort of the opposite of, it's sort of counterintuitive to what we would like to think of. We're breathing in healing, right? And breathing out the bad stuff. In this case, we breathe in suffering and we breathe out light and healing to others. It's a very powerful practice. And when we do it for ourselves, we breathe in that awareness of our own suffering along with everyone else who right now is feeling similarly persecuted, lonely, angry, all those ways that we saw, ill. Everyone else right now who is suffering in a very similar way. And this might sound like impossibly burdensome, like, oh, how can I breathe that all in? But we breathe it out, we breathe out ease and light and healing. And we don't do this in a with the sense that we're going to make this happen. We do it as a way of really working with our own heart, our own state. And in my experience anyway, when I do Tonglen practice for myself in that way of including others, I find then I feel myself included. In a sense of this source of care that's flowing through me. And I feel a palpable sense of kinship with others in this human mess we live in, you know, this human condition. So this is what Vimalakirti is suggesting to Manjushri for a bodhisattva who's feeling discouraged, who's feeling ill. And then he concludes his advice by saying, tell them to recall the good fortune they have won through spiritual practice. You know, to be grateful that we're even in a position to be practicing, to have, you know, that our lives have given us enough support to be able to make this choice to live a conscious life. Because not everybody is in a position to even choose to try. So to be grateful, to concentrate on a life of purity and not to give way to gloom or worry. They should cultivate constant diligence, striving to become a king of physicians, or a master of physicians who can heal the ailments of the assembly. This is how a bodhisattva should comfort and instruct a bodhisattva who is ill. So sometimes we really do need encouragement like that. You know, the bodhisattva path is not easy, and the pitfalls are many. So I want to maybe mention a few of the pitfalls. Reading this sutra, you might think that Vimalakirti is saying the way to comfort your bodhisattva friend who is ill is to sit there and preach. preach the Dharma with a list of things that they should be doing. And have you ever tried to help a friend who's deeply discouraged, you know, deeply depressed or anxious, and found that they're stubbornly resistant to your wisdom? Or maybe you've been on the other side of that exchange, when you've been, you know, really low, and someone tries to argue you out of it, even if they're saying all the right things. It doesn't work so well, often, right? If you've ever felt you've been in that stuck place where words just can't quite touch it. So it's good to remember. It's good to remember the criteria for right speech when you're trying to be a bodhisattva. Is it true? Is it kind? And is it the right timing? Because if it's not the right timing, it's not going to work. And also, a little extension of that is, this is practice of right speech, basically one of the Eightfold Path. Is it true doesn't just mean is it right or if it's wrong. You know, we need to be able to hold some gray area sometime and not take an absolute stance. So that's part of it. Be aware of your tendency to exaggerate, one way or the other, better or worse. Be aware of that. Temper your tendency to exaggerate. Are you saying one thing to one person and a completely different thing to somebody else? You know? That's another element of right speech. And also just disparaging unkind language. Those are really all important parts of right speech. And also to remember all the nonverbal ways, that we receive the teachings, the Dharma of impermanence and no separate self and the nature of suffering. We learn a lot about those truths non-verbally. So maybe taking your ailing bodhisattva friend for a walk in the forest might be the best thing. Or what else can you think of?
Listening.
Just listening. Just bearing witness is one of the most powerful things. And also, part of that is trusting them. Trusting them to feel their way with your presence, your full attentive presence. Trusting them to find their way out of that funk that they're in. Or maybe just very careful little opening question here and there, but just listening, yeah. What else?
Make a meal.
Yeah, nice pot of soup, right?
I was going to say bring another glass of water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Similar. Yeah, I mean, yeah, remember last week, if you were here, I told that story of the woman I knew whose young adult son had died in a fluke, just stupid fluke accident. And she was just immobilized. She wanted to die. And the best thing that she was so grateful for was a guy, a neighbor, somebody he wasn't even a close friend, just showed up every morning and sat with her for a little while and brought her a banana. And that's one thing she felt she could eat. So she just ate this banana every day. And she said, I think that guy saved my life. Mm. Right? He didn't try and talk her out of it. Yeah. So that's I just really want to bring that up. So you don't think this bodhisattva practice is all about preaching. There are other ways, and just, you know, the quality of our own presence. And some of you listening to all this might feel kind of daunted by the great suffering you may encounter in your workplaces, if you're in the front lines of poverty, injustice, health care, environmental or climate crises. You might be feeling like you're already approaching burnout or compassion fatigue. So yikes, how am I supposed to, you know, be like Vimalakirti? So here's another distinction I think might be helpful, is the distinction between empathy and compassion. Because what's called compassion fatigue is probably more rightly to be termed empathy fatigue. And here's why. And this comes from a French born and raised Tibetan monk named Mathieu Ricard, who left a career as a cellular geneticist to study Buddhism. I mean, he's quite young, and became a Tibetan monk. And he's written about his experiences participating in neuroscience research on empathy and compassion. He was a subject. He was asked by the researchers to alternate periods where he would induce a feeling of empathy by imagining someone suffering with periods of simply relaxing his mind in a neutral state without doing any kind of meditation. All the time being monitored by a magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. So imagine trying to do that. Well, anyway, he could do it. And after this first session, the researcher asked him what he'd been doing, because the results were different from what they expected or what they usually observed in subjects feeling empathy for another's suffering. And so here's what he said. I explained that I had meditated on unconditional compassion, trying to feel a powerful feeling of love and kindness for people who are suffering, but also for all sentient beings. In fact, complete analysis of the data carried out subsequently confirmed that the cerebral networks activated by meditation on compassion were very different from those activated by linked to empathy. In previous studies, people who were not trained in meditation observed a person who was seated near the scanner and received painful electric shocks in the hand. I didn't think they could still do research like this, but that's what he says. These researchers noted that a part of the brain associated with pain is activated in subjects who observe someone else suffering. They suffer when they see someone else suffering, and the part of the brain that's activated is the part that's emotionally reactive to that suffering, okay? The distress we feel, the emotional distress we feel. And then he continues, he said, when I engaged in meditation on altruistic love and compassion, the researcher noted that the cerebral networks activated were very different. Not the ones associated with that aversive negative reaction to pain, but in fact it was the areas of the brain associated with positive emotions, with feelings of affiliation, with connection and maternal love and caring. So feelings of connection and care were activated when he did that practice. So you can feel empathy for someone who's in a state of rage, right? You have your own feelings of rage activated, right? Or, you know, aversive states or painful states. Empathy is feeling another's pain, resonating with another's pain. But compassion is connected with this sense of connection and care. So it's a different feeling. So they had to do the experiment again on this guy. The next day, he followed the instructions for what he was supposed to do, to feel empathy for others' sufferings. And he had just watched a BBC documentary the night before about physically and mentally handicapped children in a Romanian hospital where they were horribly abused and neglected. And so again, he alternated between visualizing these children that he'd just seen in the documentary and resonating with their suffering, and then short periods of rest. After an hour, he was exhausted and overwhelmed with feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, and distress, as he was empathizing in that way that's identifying with. That's the other thing. It's the difference between identifying with and the feeling of compassion. So the researcher, after an hour, said, "Would you like to shift back to your compassion practice?" And he said, "Yeah, I do." And he said this: "Scarcely had I shifted the orientation of my meditation to love and compassion before my mental landscape transformed completely. The images of the children suffering were still just as present and strong. Now I felt a profound, heartwarming courage linked to limitless love for these children. Meditating now on compassion, I felt like I had opened a gate, loosing floods of love that permeated the suffering of these children." So they tried this on other people, training them in the two different ways to feel empathy and to feel compassion. And the results, even with people who were relatively new to this practice, were consistent. So what this suggests is that empathy alone can lead to overwhelm, fatigue, and burnout. When we're kind of just identifying with or resonating with suffering. He uses the term altruistic love, but we could also say loving kindness, metta, and compassion. So this is love without self-clinging, it's love without an agenda, and compassion that, again, using his words, far from leading to distress and discouragement, reinforces our strength of mind, our inner balance, and our courageous, loving determination to help those who suffer. So I thought that distinction is really helpful so we can notice it in ourselves. So when we can notice when we're getting lost in a kind of empathy that evokes discouragement and pain and overwhelm. And the good news about all this is that this kind of compassion that he's describing is something we can practice and cultivate in our practice. That our practice gives us the means to develop a robust, resilient capacity for loving kindness and compassion, which ultimately is inexhaustible. It's not about us personally. It can't be depleted. And as we know, our world today, we badly need people with that capacity. And we don't have to be Vimalakirtis, you know. We just need to gradually grow our capacity to be present with suffering, our own, whether it's our family member or the wide screen of global crises. Not to turn away, to stay grounded, and to open our heart in compassion. Another really helpful, I think, helpful distinction, it comes from Rachel Naomi Remen. Some of you will know that name. She's a physician who has done wonderful work teaching other physicians about burnout and about humanizing their practice, how to stay connected to their patients. And her teaching arose from her own decades-long experience of chronic illness. So I see her as another kind of living Vimalakirti for our own day, using her own experience of illness to deepen understanding in her profession and beyond. And she talks about the difference between helping, fixing, and serving. She said helping is based on inequality. When we use our own strength to help those of lesser strength who can't do it. And people feel this inequality, right? When we help, we may inadvertently diminish their self-esteem, their sense of confidence, you know, and we say, oh, well, I'm trying to help you, right? Or I'm just trying to help. But that can not see the worth and integrity and wholeness in the person we're helping. But when we serve, we are also served. When we serve, we draw from all our experiences. Even our limitations can serve, our wounds can serve, or even our darkness can serve. We can offer up our imperfect lives in service, and it's a circular thing. When I used to train hospice volunteers, they'd often say, well, I receive more than I give from those connections with families and patients. The other thing about helping is it tends to incur debt. You know, people who feel that then they owe you something back. But serving is mutual. And then fixing, she says fixing, when it's a fixing relationship, there's something that's broken, right? And you have to fix it. And you have to have the skill to fix it. So again, there's a distance between the fixer and the fixed, a separation. And fixing can be a form of judgment. You need to fix what's wrong with you. Right? You need me to fix you. And judgment, again, creates a disconnection. We can't serve from a distance. We can only serve that to which we're profoundly connected, that which we're willing to touch. Rachel Naomi Remen says, fundamentally, helping, fixing, and service are ways of seeing life. When you help, you see life as weak. When you fix, you see life as broken. When you serve, you see life as whole. She also says fixing and helping are the basis of curing, but not of healing. She says, in my 40 years of chronic illness, I have been helped by many people and fixed by a great many others who did not recognize my wholeness. All that fixing and helping left me wounded in some important and fundamental ways. Only service heals. So I think these three modes aren't necessarily separate, they overlap. When you break your hip, you want an orthopedic, a really very good orthopedic surgeon to repair it, right? You need a good fixer. When you need something done that's beyond your own strength or skills, you need the help of someone who has that, those strengths or those skills. But if the people who do that fixing and helping also do it with the heart of service, it feels very different. Even if your plumber comes and fixes your toilet with the heart of service, it feels different. Maybe you've noticed. And certainly if your physician or your surgeon mends you with a heart of service, it feels different. It's healing. And it can create that feeling of mutuality and connection, which manifests the truth of the words that we chant in our Zen meal chant. May we all realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And emptiness, of course, means the interconnection of giver, receiver, and gift. So that our human relationships are a continuous flow of exchange. But there are things that obstruct that flow, that come from our habit patterns and our conditioning. And so, just like us, Manjushri realizes that it takes a resilient mind and an open heart to do the work of a bodhisattva. And there are lots of obstacles. So he asks, how should a bodhisattva who is ill go about tempering and controlling the mind? You know, what are some practices, what are some ways that we can deal with those obstructions? So that will be what we'll talk about on Wednesday, how Vimalakirti answers that question. Okay, so I think I've already talked too long, so I will stop and we'll chant together and then we'll go right into service, okay?
Page 3 of your chant book.
Thank you everyone for listening.